You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Alan Chews is NPR's Voice of Books. His latest work of nonfiction is A Trance After Breakfast. His latest novel is A Song of Slaves in the Desert. He has a new collection of novellas out as an ebook called Paradise or Eat Your Face. Thank you for joining me, Alan.
Pleasure again, Rick.
Alan, we have here three books that have a lot in common, I think. They have a similar theme, and what they really have in common beyond anything else is economy. These three books, in a small number of pages we have here, pack more punch than a number of books that have probably twice the page count.
Yeah, well, certainly the Alice Oswald version of the Iliad goes together with Kevin Powers' war novel. One war in Troy and then another war in Iraq. It's two very distinctively different kinds of wars, but the emotions war engenders in people is quite the same, much in the same way that love makes you feel the same way, whether it was 10,000 years ago or now. The amazing thing about Oswald's poem is called Memorial, and she calls it a version of the Iliad, is that in under 100 pages, she manages to boil down the essence of the battlefield deaths of all of the soldiers in the Iliad among the Greeks. And then she uses Greek. She doesn't directly translate Greek, but she says in her little discussion of what she's trying to do here, she looks through the Greek and produces a mourner's lament for a number of these soldiers. So she gives you lists of names, and then she gives you these laments, which are certainly Homeric in their metaphorical power. And she gives you this feeling, this keening feeling of mournfulness and the sadness that sets in after death. And certainly it begins here on the battlefield, but it can go on to include just anyone's demise.
The lists of names are so striking. To just read them aloud is, I think, a really important part of this, to take in that idea of just the list of names. When you read a list of names, there's generally only one reason you're reading that list.
Yes, I remember, I mean, you know, I've read the Iliad a couple of times, and I remember some of the deaths that she focuses on, but certainly not all of them. And the metaphors that grow out of these deaths are pretty much hers, as she invents them based on what she calls the lament tradition that she finds embedded in the Iliad itself. So the sorrowful response to these deaths by the Homer poet is something that she builds on here. And it's also, I think she certainly plays off against the Vietnam War memorial also, that list of names. So if you read this, you can go to the Vietnam War memorial and see it in see those names in metaphor context, I think. But let me read. As you say, it opens with this huge list of names of almost all of the Greeks that are dead. There are more than 100 of them. Protasilios, Etkapolos, Elphenor, Samosius, Lucos, Demokuon, Diores, Pyrrhus, Phygius, Idaeus, Odios, Phaestus, Scamandrius. I mean, it just goes on and on, and then she opens the poem. The first to die was Protesilaus, a focused man who hurried to darkness with 40 black ships, leaving the land behind. Men sailed with him from those flower-lit cliffs where the grass gives growth to everything. Parassus, Iton, Teleus, Antron. He died in midair, jumping to be first ashore. There was his house half built, his wife rushed out, clawing her face. Podarkus, his altogether less impressive brother, took over command, but that was long ago. He's been in the black earth now for thousands of years.
It's so perfectly elegiac. I mean, it just really captures this aching void that is left in the wake of battle. And I think it's beautifully done. And it's despite the fact that it's a vision of, or not a translation of, the Iliad, really, it seems just really grittily contemporary. I think that her language is, she knows how to use specific language to really ground us in these places and take us to these places. And it feels very real and it's present, even though it's not set in the present. And I think that's an important accomplishment, to take us so close to these people and so close to their feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I should read some of these, the similes and metaphors that she produces at the end of each life. I'll just read this sequence. And Hippodamus died, like a traveler trudging across a plain who comes to a river and stands helpless, looking down at that foamy swiftness sweeping to the sea, and takes a step back. Chersidamus, like a fish in the wind, jumps right out of its knowledge and lands on the sand. Dolops, the strongest son of Lampus, not believing he could die, even when his spear hit solid metal and banged back again, even when a man hacked off his helmet and he saw his own eye holes staring up at him from the ground. It was not until the beak of death pushed out through his own chest that he recognized the wings of darkness. Like when God unwinds his whirlwind, a single cloud moves into the middle sky. Melanippus, not really a fighter, more a farmer. Periphetos, the man from Mycenae who tripped on his shield. Just every death here, you know, Pound, I think it's an ABC reading, Ezra Pound remarks, Homer must have been an army doctor, because every death in the Iliad is different from every other death. And certainly you get that sense that it's completely Homeric.
And she does some really nice stuff with repetition.
Yes, she repeats those, most of the similes or metaphors that come after the death.
Dicuon, the Trojan, was too eager, too heroic. He found praise yet, but also death. Like snow falls quickly from God to the ground when the north wind blows down the heavens. Like snow falls quickly from God to the ground when north wind blows down from the heavens. The way she paces this, mm-hmm, and lays it out for us, it's graceful and easy to read and beautiful, and it's a really wonderful accomplishment.
It's hard to know whether this will keep people from going to war or making more people go to war, because it's both horrendous in the way she describes the deaths, and also, we have to face it, beautiful in the way in which she celebrates those deaths.
That's an interesting question.
But to go from this ancient war thousands of years ago, if it ever occurred, if it wasn't just something somebody made up, as the Homers did, to the Iraq War, Kevin Parra's novel, The Yellow Birds, is a poet's novel. Mm. I found it very interesting because it's episodic. He goes back and forth between the U.S. before the main character, this machine gunner named Bartle, goes into battle. Then there's scenes of him in battle, and then there's scenes with him at home after the war, and then back into the war again. So there's very little sense of pure narrative time going on here. But what he manages to pull off is a memorable, really beautiful, evocative, elegiac work of art about death and dying and war. And it's a first novel, and he's a poet, but this is a work of fiction, and he really pulls it off. You get a sense of Bartle's disturbed vision of the world, having gone through all of these events.
I think the achronological mode of storytelling really helps that kind of create that kind of disjointed effect. What's nice is that, on one hand, the episodic, the back and forth, the all over the map feel of where things go, create this sense of diffraction, distraction that Bartle experiences. That we understand how he experiences life, but for us as readers, there's also a great deal of pleasure in putting these pieces back together again, and sorting out the narrative as we go through. And I think that's a really interesting, creates a kind of a friction that is not, that makes the novel really compulsively readable.
Well, I agree. Although, you know, whenever you construct a novel in this fashion, you're taking a chance. It's either going to work the way you just described, or it's going to be a mess. In this case, it works.
And I think that helps. You know, what helps too is, by virtue of the fact that he's a poet, his prose is really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that with the power of the prose in these paragraphs, in these episodes, that allows, gives us threads and ways to go through the book that tie it together and make it seem more homogeneous.
Yeah. Well, he's certainly a man in distress, and he manages to dramatize that distress by the fragmented vision that he presents without making the reader feel as though they're looking at a world in a broken mirror. He gets home from war, which happens in the middle of the book, and then he goes back to war. But here's a bit of his prose. He falls asleep. "The river had a dream in it. I faced the opposite bank and stood there naked in the water. I saw a band of horses in a field dotted with dogwood and willow. Each was like the others in temperament, all roans except for a single old palomino that looked at me as the others grazed in the thin moonlight. It was bloodied on its hooves and carried the marks of both lash and brand on its haunches." I mean, there you get that sense of agony, the agony of war and the scars of war in that elegiac image of the horse that emerges.
Well, that's one of the most effective aspects of this book, is that it operates, I think, on a subconscious level, and it evokes feelings in the reader that the reader's not, you know, you're not necessarily aware of, and thus creating a sympathy with the speaker and the story and the experience itself. I think that's a, you know, again, that's something that I think comes out of a poetic background.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's and the prose holds all of these experiences together. He's in Nineveh province, and they find a comrade of theirs who's been killed, and his body rigged as a bomb. He says. "The lieutenant stood and turned to us, but before he could utter a word, we were overtaken by blindness, as if the sun had fallen out of the sky. We were covered in dust and deafened before any sound could reach us. I lay groggy on the ground, and my ears rang and buzzed loudly, and as I looked up, I saw the rest of the platoon moving on the ground, trying to get their bearings. Sterling was covered in black dust. His mouth moved, and he gestured to his rifle, pointing out what he saw, and began to fire at it. In alleys beneath us, closer to the riverbank, and in windows above us, we saw the tips of rifles and hands. The buzz in my head was oppressive, and I couldn't hear the bullets as they passed, but I felt a few as they cut the air. The fight was hazy and without sound, as if it was happening underwater."
Seems so filmic, too, I think. You can really feel it and see it. He's quite good at putting you, I think, actually right in the experiential aspect of this. It really captures you and puts you in this place. And it's a scary place. There's lots of horror, I think, and the scene you read is a good example of that. But there's also, I think, a feeling of, you know, joy and care in this.
I don't know where I'd go so far as joy, but certainly a certain pleasure in the way the language sounds and takes these horrible events and makes use of them in this particular guy's
art. He's crafted a thing of beauty out of a thing of horror. There's no doubt about that.
So two wars, thousands of years between them, and poetry comes out of both. It's
interesting to see the poets speaking out about war and doing such a good job. I suppose that's ever the job of the poet.
I agree. And you don't have to be a warrior to do what Oswald did with the Iliad. And you can go to war and make no sense of it all, unless you're have this poet's mind or novelist's sense of narrative the way Powers does.
He does have a good sense of narrative, I think, and that's what makes this book so good. Now, I would argue that this third book that we're going to talk about, The Dog Stars by Peter Heller, is also a work that's very rare. It's a book about war, not the kind of war, not a war necessarily between nations, but the war of humanity against itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a dystopian novel set in... United States in the wake of a worldwide flu pandemic. Those people who have survived, most of them, are basically struggling to do that. And our narrator is a man who has trained as a pilot. He's got an old Cessna that he flies. He's known...
Calls it the Beast.
Yeah, and he calls himself Hig, or Big Hig, as he's sometimes known. He's lost his wife in the epidemic, and has only his dog, Jasper, who is his co-pilot when he flies. He sits in the co-pilot seat when he flies over Colorado, foraging for gas and large quantities of food. He's set up camp on the tarmac of a small airfield, and on the other side of the tarmac is a man named Bangley, who turns out is an ex-SEAL. And Bangley covers his back, and he hunts and fishes for protein and brings some back to Bangley. So they have this odd kind of quote-unquote marriage, but that doesn't replace love for Hig. So he's a man who's really, as we see him in the beginning, really lost. And he loses a couple other things. I don't want to be a spoiler here and say what, but before the novel ends, he finds himself somehow again. The vision of this world is brutal, but also elegiacally conveyed to us at the same time.
It's the most charming novel of the apocalypse you're going to read this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's a first novel, and I was thinking of Karen Walker Thompson, The Age of Miracles, another first novel about the way the world might end. I mean, in that book, the world shifts off its axis and begins to slow down in its rotation. Here, the Earth goes merrily along. It's just the population has shifted off its axis, and... seems to be both slowing down and speeding up. But it's a beautifully, beautifully told story. It's done almost as if in journal entries, short bursts of prose, scenes that really don't, the longest, I don't think, goes longer than a couple of pages. So it's staccato-like, almost like an SOS signal bursting into your mind.
This novel, with, I think, the other two, has... displays the virtues of economy in terms of storytelling.
Yeah.
It's stripped to the bone, as is the world. And I think that I like this book. And we were talking a bit about this in the Karen Walker book, that I think that this is kind of a new form that we're seeing more of, what I call unspeculative fiction, where you make one tiny speculation that doesn't seem that far off base. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you kind of just subtract out most of our current civilization, mm-hmm. and then strip people down and mm-hmm. just see. It's a way of getting closer to seeing what humans are without all the accoutrements and trappings that keep us frantically running as fast as we can to stay in place.
Yeah, all the things we love. Like reading novels like this and talking about them.
Well, novels like this are certainly worth talking about and certainly worth reading. I think that these three books offer, though they have some similarities, they're all very different.
Mm-hmm.
They'll stay with you for a long time.
Yeah, I think Dog Stars may, who knows, win a couple of prizes. That's my guess.
Really? I think it's certainly audacious in what it does, because to approach this kind of scenario, it has a lot of the elegiac feel of, you know, that we've heard since On the Beach, Neville mm-hmm. Shoot. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of that going for it, but I think it's also, there's some more charm in it. And I think that's an interesting element to throw into this kind of work.
This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but with a dog in the co-pilot seat.
I've been speaking with Alan Chews. He's the voice of books for National Public Radio. His latest work of nonfiction is A Trance After Breakfast. His latest novel is Song of Slaves in the Desert. His collection of novellas, available as an e-book, is Paradise or Eat Your Face. The books we discussed today were The Dog Stars by Peter Heller, The Yellow Birds by Kevin Powers, and Memorial, a version of Homer's Iliad by Alice Oswald. Thank you for joining me, Alan.
Great pleasure, Rick.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.